This is another Knights of the Precious Blood podcast.
This talk is titled Fortitude in Practice and is presented by Father Richard Wallace.
So let's do a little review of what we learned 2 hours ago. We learned about fortitude, that it is the virtue by which fear is moderated. We learned that every moral virtue has an excess and a defect. We learned that the moral virtues are our daily weaponry to get to God. And we saw the story of the Franciscan nuns who were martyred. We also saw the importance of prudence in directing the moral virtues. And prudence itself has to be directed by charity, which means we have to be in the state of grace. So let's continue on now. Parts of fortitude. Now, little did you know that each of the moral virtues contains sub-virtues in it. So, for example, in justice, there's about 20 sub-virtues in that. In temperance, there's like 15 or 20 as well. In fortitude, there are 4 sub-virtues. These virtues, they aren't exactly fortitude, but they share things in common with fortitude so that you can, with common sense, call them fortitude. Practice in concrete ways. Because as we're going to see, remember I said fortitude has to do with fear and suffering? Each of these 4 virtues has to do with fear and suffering as well. Let's check them out then. So the first one is called magnanimity. Magnanimity comes from 2 words. Magna animus means a big heart. This is the one of the most beautiful of all the virtues, actually. This is what it is. Magnanimity is the virtue by which one does great deeds despite the suffering and fear involved. So this virtue concerns doing great deeds. As we said, it's one of the most beautiful and attractive of all the virtues because it inspires a man to do great things for God despite the obstacles that he might come into. So, prime example is St. Paul. He's in the picture right there. He's preaching in Rome, talking about that pagan God and trying to bring people to the truth. St. Paul knew that by going around the whole world to preach, he would be hurt, he would be hungry, he would be persecuted. But he still said, I want to do this for Christ. That's what a magnanimous heart is. So do you see how this is part of fortitude? Remember, fortitude means moderating your fear. We see how that happens in here, because when you're going to do a great work, there's always something like, man, this is going to be difficult. Which implies fear. Whenever something is difficult, that always means there's fear. You know, oh, this is going to be difficult. I'm going to get white hairs by doing this. You know, it's going to be stressful. For example, putting together this men's retreat is a magnanimous work. Whoever did this, practice the virtue of magnanimity, because it's not easy to do. You have to organize things, get everyone together, do all these plans and have a backup plan, and then you lose sleep over it. There's suffering involved. But that's what it takes to be magnanimous, to take on great works for God. Let's look at some prime examples of magnanimity, because St. Paul is a really great example, but we all can't be St. Paul. He's unique. Let's look at some lay saints in the past century who practiced magnanimous works. So, the left side, you have St. Louis Martin. He is the father of St. Therese of the Child Jesus. He was a very magnanimous man because in his town of Alençon in France, he started nocturnal adoration. He started a group of guys that did all-night adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. So it's obviously not St. Paul, but nevertheless, it's still a very magnanimous work, suited to his state of life. Because that involves suffering, right? Staying up and doing adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. Many people would just rather leave or say, this is boring, I can't do this, I'd rather sleep, I need my beauty sleep. No, it's a great work to dedicate oneself to doing that. The second saint is Blessed Maria Echeverria, and she was a Paraguayan young woman who died in, I think, 1960. She's really famous for two magnanimous works. When she was a teenager, she was part of Catholic Action, which basically means she did evangelizing, she taught catechism. She dedicated her youth to doing great things for God. That's magnanimous. And then she did a further magnanimous work. She felt the vocation to become a Carmelite. So in her 20s, she became a Carmelite. And that's a lot of difficulty and suffering involved, but she did it. She actually died very young. She died at 30 years old, like many, many young saints do. Prime example, Blessed Carlo Acutis, who died at the age of 16. He did a great magnanimous work. He started a website that documented all the Eucharistic miracles throughout the world. That's magnanimous, because it requires dedication, requires suffering. Imagine how many sacrifices he had to make to upkeep that website, not hanging out with his friends, coming to all these difficulties with the programming. Oh, I messed up, I have to do this again. It's a difficult work, magnanimous. At the top you have Blessed Maria and her husband Luigi Quattrocci. They were an Italian couple who lived in the early 1900s. The reason I put them up here is because I just wanted to let you know that the desire to have a family is a magnanimous work. One of the most magnanimous works that you can do in this life, because it fulfills all the things in the definition of magnanimity. It's a great work for God, yes, and there's fear and suffering involved, for sure. Because who here has a family and said you haven't suffered? No one. Who here has a family and said you never had fear? No one. So having my family is a very magnanimous work. And it's especially magnanimous for parents when they decide to accept another child, even though it's very difficult for them. So, who is more magnanimous, for example? You know, man and woman married, 25 years old. They said, we really want our first kid. We've been married for 6 months. Okay, that's magnanimous, but it's actually quite natural for them to desire a child. It's going to come pretty easily. Compare them with, you know, a couple that's like, you know, 40 years old. They've already had 8 kids. And they said, yes, we want another child. That's really magnanimous, because they know the difficulty involved and they still want to do that. I know, and it's especially magnanimous for the woman, because she's the one who has to give birth to the children. So I know the lady that goes to my church, I'm not going to name who she is, because some of you actually probably have seen her around, but she is really magnanimous, because she has, I'm not going to say how many kids she has, because then you'll know who she is. Every time she has a child, she has basically 9 months of really bad morning sickness. So she basically is bedridden the whole time, or most of the time. And the doctor actually told her, you need to stop having kids. And you know what she told the doctor? No, I want to have more kids. So it's a really magnanimous work. And her husband is not forcing her to do it. Her husband is on her side and he lets her discern and everything. So that's a really magnanimous work to have a family, especially when it requires heroic sacrifice. Now, let me tell you about one of the greatest works of magnanimity that you can do. If the slide goes to the next slide. Here we go, okay. So, one of the greatest proofs of magnanimity is to live a deep prayer life. That's probably the most important thing I want you to remember today, more than anything else. There is nothing so grand, nothing so important, nothing so difficult than to live a deep prayer life. I can promise you that. To live a deep prayer life is the most difficult thing you'll do. It's the most sacrificial thing you'll do. It'll cost you more than anything else you've ever done in your life. But it's the most magnanimous work that you can do. I promise you that. And that's why St. Teresa, the child Jesus, who was basically just a little French girl who never left her country and never left her city, really. Well, she did leave her country for a few weeks. She was greatly magnanimous because she dedicated her life to God in prayer. Therefore, when we're thinking of magnanimity, we must not just think of it in external terms. You know, like, I want to build a church. I want to do a big project. I want to build an awesome, you know, community or a website. Those are good things. But the true magnanimous man is in the heart, towards God, through prayer and sacrifice. Simple as that. Now, just like the other moral virtues, magnanimity falls into a golden mean, which means it has its excess and it has its defect. Now, the defect is called pusillanimity, and the excess is called ambition. So let's talk about, do I have both of the slides? Yes. So, pusillanimity. This literally means small heart, small-heartedness. The opposite of magnanimity. Pusillanimity is a vice because it refuses to take on difficult works because of fear. So the person is capable, but he says, no, I'm too scared. So it's the opposite of magnanimity. You know, you're called to do this great, great work, but you say, no, I can't do it. We see this in the parable of the talents, parable of the minas. In which Matthew 25, remember, the master gives 5 talents to 1 servant. By talents here, we mean coins. It's a currency of money. 5 coins to 1 servant, 2 coins to another servant, 1 coin to another servant. What does a servant with 1 coin do? He buries it in the ground. He doesn't increase it by trading. So the master comes back, and he says this to him, you wicked and slothful servant. It's funny, he doesn't say to them, well, I understand, servant, you're just scared. It's all right. He doesn't say that to them. He says, you're wicked. Because the servant feared too much. That was his reason, actually. He says, master, I hid your money because I was afraid of you. And this is what he replies with, you wicked and slothful servant. So we should know that fear can be a sin, can lead us into sin. If it stops us from doing something that we should do, it gives us a small heart. For example, if my superiors told me, Father Wallace, we've chosen you to be the superior of Australia. And I said, I'm too scared to do it, I'm not doing it. Well, that would be a sin if I said no out of fear. Because I know that God wants me to do it, but I'm saying no. Or again, it can be a sin, because we have to have prudence in this one too, if a parent does not correct his child out of fear. Now again, there are 1,001 ways in this can happen, and which sometimes it's a sin and sometimes it's not. But, you know, say for example that if the child, a teenager or something, started looking at pornography, it's the father's obligation to tell him, you can't do that. That's a sin. If the father, though, is like, well, I'm too scared because I'm afraid he's going to backlash against me, and then he's going to, you know, get mad at me, and we're going to be further. No, so you can't compromise on this. You have to tell him. It's your responsibility to tell him. You can't let fear get the best of you here. So that's one very extreme, it's actually not that extreme, that situation. It can happen pretty commonly. So it's our obligation to teach people, despite the fact that what we say is going to, or I'm scared to say this thing. It happens all the time, and not all the time, but sometimes when I'm talking to people, I say, man, I don't want to say this to them, but I'm going to have to say it. They're not going to react well, okay, but I have to say it. So I'm being magnanimous. If I didn't say it, I would be pusillanimous. So that's the vice of pusillanimity. Now the opposite is ambition, as we said. It seems magnanimous, but it ain't. It's called ambition. Ambition takes on difficult works, just like magnanimity does, but there's a problem. It either does them for selfish motives, or the works are just trivial, or the work exceeds one's strength. So the prime example I put here is the Tower of Babel. In Genesis chapter 11, we read that men got together and said, let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we'll be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Okay, so first of all, it seems magnanimous. You're like, wow, what a great tower. It's an accomplishment of human wisdom. But what was their intention to do it? To make a name for themselves. And therefore, it was not magnanimous, it was ambitious. So, you know, for example, like, you can't really call like a big football stadium a work of magnanimity. Look at the size of this stadium, it's so big, and it's a magnanimous work. Well, it's trivial. I don't want to say it's trivial, but it's not the greatest thing you can do. So I wouldn't call that the prime example of magnanimity. It might be ambition, especially because it's about making money in the end. So that's ambition. We sometimes have to judge our intentions when we're doing a magnanimous work, because there's very much the intention, there can be the intention for ambition. Say, for example, if you started a YouTube channel about the faith, you have good intentions, but it's very easy to fall into, you might call it the views trap, where you're like, oh, I'm going to get so many views, I want people to see me, I want to be famous and everything. Wow, okay, watch out, because a magnanimous work is turning into an ambitious work because of the intrusion of selfish motives. Now, let's look at the next of the four parts of fortitude, munificence. Never heard these words before, right? They're very strange words, munificent. Munificence is the virtue by which one is ready to incur great expenses in necessary works. So this virtue actually concerns money. Money is something that's regulated by virtue. So this is like magnanimity, but it involves money. Why? Well, this virtue is contained in fortitude because dealing with money and projects is a difficult task. It requires prudence, foresight, caution. It's a difficult thing. So, for example, Father Seifer, who's trying to build a church for the FSSP, is doing a munificent work because it involves lots of money, actually. He has to raise money. He has to put it in the right places and guard it and plan out. Now go up to him and ask him, Father Seifer, is it easy? Do you love doing it? He'll tell you, no, it's giving me white hairs. So that's why it's a part of fortitude, because it's not easy dealing with money and big projects. We have to admit this virtue is more practiced by the wealthy than the poor. Because if someone's poor, they can still do munificent works, but really just in a smaller proportion. Just like the widow in the gospel who put all of her two mites into the collection. She was still being munificent, but proportionally speaking, not in the same way that a millionaire would be munificent. but she was still practicing the true virtue. I put a picture here of St. Elizabeth of Hungary. She was a princess in the 13th century who used her money to build hospitals for the poor. So she didn't just waste it on random things. She did magnanimous works, and even she herself served in them, as you see in that painting right there. She served the poor herself. Now, does munificence have an excess and a defect? Of course it does. Let's see what they are. The defect is called niggardliness. So if someone's... This niggardliness means that someone's basically a cheapskate. That's basically what it means. The vice of niggardliness. So this is when one refuses unreasonably to incur great expenses even when necessary. So it's hard to give examples for this, you know. Say you're just building a church and you're like, well, I just don't want to spend money. Let's just make it, you know, just like cheap particle board church. Well, you shouldn't have a particle board church if you have like millions of dollars to make a nice church. So that's a very basic example. The opposite, though, is unreasonable expenditure. And that's when you're basically throwing in too much money and you're just wasting your money. You know, like, we're gonna get an Olympic-sized swimming pool in our new church, because it's going to be useful for the priests. Well, I don't think so. That's the vice of unreasonable expenditure. So we don't have to talk about this because it's not too important for us. The next virtue contained in fortitude is patience. Patience is part of fortitude. Know that. Patience is the virtue by which one endures present suffering without becoming unreasonably sorrowful. Think about that. That's what patience is. So, you know, say that you kept dropping something by accident. You know, you kept dropping your phone, and then what happens? You get angry and you curse. You say something and you kick it and you throw a fit. That's being impatient. And that's a sin. Why? Because it's not reasonable to let yourself be so sorrowful because of some trifling thing like that. So you're letting suffering and sorrow get the best of you. That's what makes impatience a sin. Patience is the building block of fortitude. It really is. If we can endure the small inconveniences in daily life, then we can endure the bigger ones with composure. It's funny how often we think we're courageous. We think, I'm a man. I'm so great. I'm so strong. Yes. Yes. But then when we get home, something little happens. You know, your kid does something small, and then you get angry and you lose it. Are you really courageous as you thought you were? If you're losing yourself over trifling things. So patience is the building block of fortitude. This is really how we must practice fortitude in daily life. You should make this man your patron. His name is St. Francis de Sales. By nature, he was very angry. But he worked so hard to put into subjection that his name is the Gentleman Saint. No one even saw him get angry. That's how much he worked at it, to curb his anger. He was so meek. He actually writes that one time he did get angry and he let it go. It was really bad, and he felt so bad about it. He was preaching and someone rang the bell 2 minutes too early, and he showed a little bit of annoyance. That's about all that he can say. Wow. That means that he was really strict with himself. That's all that he can say that he expressed in his anger. He didn't flip out and throw a wrench at someone or flip the couch over or anything like that. He's really the meekest saint that there is, and we should follow his example of gentleness and meekness. That's super important. St. Francis de Sales. Make him your patron. Family life is where patience and hence fortitude are developed. It's really in family life. How often is it easy to be patient with people here? You know, for example, right now I could say anything to any of you and you'd be patient with me. I could just like walk over your foot right now and just like trip and fall on you and you'd be like, Father, that's fine. But then you go home and then your kid does the same thing and you're like, what are you doing? Why are you tripping on me? So it's very easy to practice patience with certain people, but when we go home, we can be a completely different person. Family life is where patience is developed. Don't be like this grandma who's like, gonna like hit the kid with the scissors. And it's not really a good example of family life. Don't be like that. Yeah, the dad's just sleeping in the background. So the next, still in patience here. So patience also has an excess and a defect. The defect is called insensibility. Not many people suffer from this, so we don't have to worry about it too much. Insensibility means that you're basically unmoved by anything. You're a stoic. So basically, you know, someone's like, you know, my family, they have these different problems, you know, my auntie died, and it's difficult, and you're just like, okay, whatever. It doesn't bother me. We should be moved by people's ills. Remember, patience doesn't mean that you should be unmoved by any sorrow. It means that you should not be moved by unreasonable sorrows. And it's unreasonable to be sorrowful if you drop your iPhone on the ground. But if someone's like, yeah, my family member has died, I lost my job, and you can be sorrowful. So sorrow's like fear. It's not a bad thing, but it has to be in moderation. And we all know the excess of impatience, simply impatience, being unable to endure the difficulties in life. Now, perseverance. This is the last part of fortitude, probably the most important part, actually. Perseverance is the virtue by which one remains steadfast in a virtuous life, despite the difficulties arising from protracted action. Key word, protracted action. So you see how it's part of fortitude? Because doing something good for a long time is difficult. And that's why it's part of fortitude. Because to do a good action over and over and over again has a special difficulty in itself. Perseverance in one's vocation is especially important. And if a man were to abandon his wife and family, he has failed in perseverance. No matter how much he says, I'm manly. That's not true. We have to persevere in our vocations. Definitely. There's very much a culture these days of people who want to get annulments. But it doesn't work like that. Annulment is not something that you just go in and get for if you're tired of your wife or she's tired of you. You have to persevere in your vocation. Basic life principle, it's easy to begin, inconvenient to continue, and difficult to persevere in anything good. It's very easy to begin something good, right? For example, when you started your rosary thing at the cathedral, the first day you started, a lot of people always come. The next week, less. Next week, less. And you're like, oh, we have to do something to get them back. So you have to draw them back in. That's how groups always are. The first group meeting is like, yeah, it's so exciting. And then it just dwindles down after that. So you have to pull them back in. Now, this virtue is so important that we even have to think about it when we fall into sin, because it's very easy when we fall into sin to say, well, I fail, I'm just going to give up. What's the point? You know, I'm just going to go all out until my next confession, because what's the point? That's not perseverance. It's perseverance to say, yes, I've fallen once, and I'm not going to fall again. I'm going to get up on my feet again right now. That's perseverance. Now, our Lord says that he implies that many people are not going to persevere in the end when he says, because iniquity hath abounded, the charity of many shall grow cold. But they that shall persevere to the end, he shall be saved. Wow. Some people will not persevere in life. It's a frightening thought to know that there are people in hell right now who were saints when they were alive. They were saints, and now they're in hell. Why is that? Because they didn't persevere. Oppositely, there are people in heaven right now who were great sinners when they were alive, but they changed and they persevered in the end. So we're always taught by the church, never, never assume that you're just going to make it to the end. Because he who thinks, I'm fine, I'm going to make it. No. You have to always walk with caution. I put this picture here of St. Francis Borgia. It's St. Francis trying to convert a dying sinner. And often for us priests, it takes perseverance to convert people. It's not an easy task, especially when someone's dying. We need to really be with them and try to convert them. I've dealt with many dying people and sick people in nursing homes, and often the way to get them, you can't get them to go to confession except after a year or two of talking to them. It takes perseverance. One of my best friends, who I helped bring back to the faith when he was 70, man, it was not easy talking to him, actually, because he's a really tough character. And it took a lot of time. But because of my perseverance, I convinced him to go to confession, receive the sacraments, and then he died a few days after Divine Mercy Sunday, after he got all the special blessings on that day. So that's what it takes. Just some people recently at the nursing home, they went to confession to me after I'd known them for 1 or 2 years, talked to them many times. Trust me, it's very easy to say, well, I'll just give up. The person's not going to go, forget about it. We have to persevere. And that's why I'm putting this picture of St. Madeleine Sophie Vera. This is something about her life. So she was a nun that died in the 1800s. And this is a little paragraph from her life. One episode stands out in the life of St. Madeleine Sophie, in which the faithful pursuit of a soul is seen in all of its pathos. For 23 years, she clung with persistent love to one whom God's providence had brought across her path, a lost sheep, who, but for the saint, could never have found the fold. Where Julie came from, no one ever knew. That was her name, Julie. She never told her own story twice in the same way. But she was alone and poor and of a difficult and wayward disposition. Like nothing in ordinary life, it was said. Deceit, deceitful, treacherous, mean, passionate to the verge of frenzy. But the saint saw only a soul, found in dangerous places by the good shepherd, and put into her care by him. She adopted her as her own child, wrote more than 200 letters to her, and suffered much on her account. Repaid by calumny and ingratitude, the saint still held on, forgave her again and again, and ever hoped. Julie died 7 years after the saint, and in peace with God. Wow. So that's what it took Saint Madeleine to convert that one lady. That's how much she had to persevere. She wrote 200 letters to her, dealt with her for 20 years, suffered so many things on account of this soul who was just basically crazy. And in the end, when she died, she didn't even know that she was converted yet. She wasn't even converted yet. It wasn't until 7 years after that Julie finally converted. That's perseverance. And we especially need this in regard to our families, because perhaps some of your children have gone away from the faith, or maybe your brothers and sisters, or even your parents. Don't lose hope, persevere. It's very easy to give up and say, oh, you kind of just accept it. It's not as if you give up, but you just say, well. Never give up, because even after you die, your work is still going on. Maybe they'll die, maybe they'll come back to the faith 10 years after you're dead. What does that matter if you see it or not? Except that they come back to God. So we have to persevere in our families and in the souls whom God gives to us. Now, again, we have excess and defect of perseverance, you'd be surprised to know. So the golden mean is perseverance. What is the defect that's called inconstancy? Inconstancy means giving up from a good work too easily because of its difficulty. That's what it means to be inconstant. Oops, I think it went off. I think the battery died. Okay, perfect. All fixed. So inconstancy is a bias. It's actually sometimes called softness. Because we're going to look at it right now, actually. Because the person is basically like, it's too difficult, I can't do it, I'm going to give up. That's a vice, because he's not persevering. Giving up because of difficulty. The opposite of perseverance is pertinacity. Someone's pertinacious when they refuse to give up some work, even though one should. Interesting, isn't it? Sometimes it's actually good to give up. That's what we're saying here. It's good to give up sometimes, because you don't want to beat a dead horse. Sometimes people do that. Maybe someone has a project and the whole thing is going so far south. Everyone has told the person stop. You know, all their superiors have told them, their family has told them. Everyone knows, this is a bad idea, you should stop doing this. And they're like, no, I'm going to persevere. No, you're not persevering, you're being pertinacious. Sometimes it's good to give up. Not on life, of course, not on God's grace. Never give up on those things, but in just projects and things. So we're not going to talk about pertinacity, because usually people don't fall into that. Let's talk about inconstancy, because people fall into this. Inconstancy is a problem these days because people have become too comfortable. Really, we've all become too comfortable. It's a problem with the youth especially. Remember, we were all youth just a few years ago. So when I say youth, I mean youth within the past 50 years. We become comfortable, and that means we become incapable of suffering. And all of a sudden, anything becomes difficult. And you're like, oh, I can't kneel on my knees for the rosary because I can't. I have to sit down on my lazy boy sofa. Well, no, you don't. Put up with it. Simple as that. So people put up with it for a really long time. Or another thing, when people come to Mass, dress in summertime attire. Super short shorts, slippers on, you know, like a t-shirt. It's not the best reason to come like that to Mass, because you say it's hot outside, but for centuries people have been dressing like this and still enduring Mass. So why should we all of a sudden say, well, I have to dress like this because I'm too hot at Mass. Well, you have to just simply accept it. The priest wears 5 layers of clothes at Mass, and he says Mass every day. For centuries, they didn't have air conditioning, and they just put up with it. And therefore, we should always dress modestly to Mass and not say the excuse that it's too hot. It's a good thing not to wear shorts to Mass. We should wear pants to Mass. Because by dressing casually, we actually make a bad example for other people. And they see, oh, I can dress like that too. You won't believe how much your example affects people. Oh, he's wearing slippers, I can do that too, no problem. No, dress nice for Mass. Cover up and just suffer through it. That's perseverance. Let's read a story, one of my favorite stories, about Blessed Henry Suso. He was a Dominican. Now, he was soft by nature. By that, I mean he was not a manly man. He's like one of these ones that kind of just like to contemplate and sit in church and like probably walk in the flowers and things like that. He wouldn't be on the court, not in the field, playing. He's more of a soft guy. But he made a resolution one day to be brave and suffer for Christ. Now, after he made that resolution, one time he was hurt by robbers. They beat him up, they left him on the field. And he forgot his resolution to be brave. He gave way to depression and crying, and he was lying there battered and just feeling bad about himself. Now, this is what Christ said to him. Look at the sarcastic tone that Christ talks to him in. He says, look at this warrior of mine. He can scale mountains, climb over rocks, break into strongholds, cut to pieces his enemies when everything is going right for him. But when he meets with adversity, his courage fades, and he is helpless and useless. In time of consolation, he is a fierce lion. But in time of tribulation, he is a timid deer. Wisdom does not share his friendship with such faint-hearted cowards. So imagine, he's saying this to Blessed Henry Suso, he's lying in the field. At this reprimand, Blessed Henry confessed that he was wrong in giving way to excessive discouragement, and went on to ask divine wisdom to allow him to weep, and so unburden his heart weighed down by grief. No, replied the voice, all the saints in heaven would lose their respect for you were you to cry like a baby or a woman. Wipe away your tears and show the world a cheerful face. So this is a saint that fell into inconstancy. And Christ didn't pick him up by saying, it's all right, don't worry. Christ said, man up, you get up. You don't have time to cry. Get on your feet. Now, we shouldn't treat everyone like this, obviously not. But he deserved to be treated like this because he was a religious. He was already quite advanced in his spiritual life, and he made a special resolution. So obviously, you can't treat children like this, and women and things. But there's probably some of you I would treat like this. I think I would treat some of you like that and say, you have no excuse. I'm not going to treat you easily here. You need to just be better and don't make excuses to me. So again, prudence is required. But usually we shouldn't treat people like this. Why? Because it's too easy and it's too pleasing to us to do it. This is an important thing that St. Francis de Sales says. He says that our zeal needs to be used with a lot of caution. Because zeal, if it's not used rightly, it's like shooting a shotgun. You're going to get the person, but it's going to blow back and hit you as well. And often people fall into sins of zeal because they try to convert someone, try to, you know, be angry towards someone, but then they end up committing a sin themselves. What's the point? So St. Francis basically says, you should only show anger and zeal 1 out of 1,000 times. That's all. In the rarest circumstances, should you ever show it, because it's a dangerous weapon that's very likely to come back and bite you. So that's why I tell you to take St. Francis as your patron. He's all about gentleness and meekness. So that's Blessed Henry Suso. Lastly, the greatest thing we can persevere in is prayer. That's the greatest thing. St. Teresa of Avila says the greatest danger she ever ran in her life was the danger, the temptation of giving up prayer. That's the greatest danger she ever ran. Wow, this must be an important thing. This is one of my favorite stories from Fulton Sheen. This is what he says in his autobiography. He says, on the day of my ordination, I made two resolutions. First, I would offer the Holy Eucharist every Saturday in honor of the Blessed Mother to solicit her protection on my priesthood. Second, I resolve also to spend a continuous holy hour every day in the presence of the Lord and the Blessed Sacrament. In the course of my priesthood, I have kept both of these resolutions. That gives me shivers just to read that. He's saying that, he's writing this 60 years later. He was a priest for 60 years. He's saying, I kept both those resolutions. I persevered in my daily holy hour for 60 years. And he even writes in his autobiography how sometimes when he was stuck in church because he had to make his holy hour and they locked him in and he had to escape from a window. And how he was in Africa at the missions because he was the propagator of the faith, so he had to go visit the missions. He wasn't even in a chapel. He didn't have the Blessed Sacrament. He had to just like wake up early in the morning in whatever hut he was in, curl up near the door and do his holy hour there. So he always did his holy hour day in and day out. That's really perfect perseverance. And that's what made him a saint, really, his holy hour. And I think God rewarded him because you know how he died? When he died? He died in front of the Blessed Sacrament in his own house. While doing adoration, he died. So that's a great grace he received. So, that's the end of the presentation. Let's look at some considerations. First, God is asking great things of me. You should know that. He's put talents into your hands. How am I answering his call to the talents, to the burdens, to the responsibilities he's put in my hands? Everyone, he's given all of us talents. By that, I mean things to watch over and do, responsibilities. Most of the time, it's going to be children who you have to care for. Or for me, it's parishioners. But it can be many other things as well. Secondly, the great things are firstly becoming holy, living a deep prayer life, and leading my family to God. Those are the first things. Those are the first works of magnanimity we should do. So we should never neglect our family to do apparent works of magnanimity in other places. It would be wrong to do that, to say, well, family, good luck for the next few weeks. I'm going to go to India and do works of mercy there. Well, it's not your job to do that. Maybe if you were single, but it's your job to care for your family first. Third, am I willing to go the extra yard to volunteer or help the church? Because often those are works of magnanimity. But it's very difficult to volunteer our time or go to the rosary at the cathedral or things like that. But it's a magnanimous work to do it. Fourth, patience is my fortitude. I'm not even going to think about really, really great external works. It's just patience at home. That's really the first thing. Fifth, how can I better persevere in the things that God wants of me? Do I waste too much time on other things? Am I too slothful or careless? I have to persevere in what God has given me. And that often requires making plans, getting rid of useless things such as internet and things like that. So, Last line, let's see what the saints have to say to us. Dear Christian soul, now you see the beauty and necessity of fortitude. The road is very difficult, but that's what it takes to obtain eternal life. Above all, may you learn the lesson that we've learned, say the saints. God is our fortitude. Alone, you will fail. But trust in God like a child in his Father, and you will be with us in eternity. Signed, the Blessed in Heaven. So, that's my presentation. Hope you all have benefited from it. We have some... Thank you.
For more great content from the Knights of the Precious Blood, visit our website, www.kofpb.org.